You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, retailers are always looking for ways to cut costs, but Chinese manufacturers have gone above and beyond. We'll find out more about sites selling products directly from factory to consumers in the United States and what can go wrong. First, growing trade tensions between the U.S. and its trading partners are starting to impact American companies. Harley-Davidson announced today that it'll be moving some of its operations to the European Union, a decision that comes after a round of back-and-forth tariffs that left the company facing a 25% price increase on bikes sold in Europe. Nathan Bomey is a business reporter with USA Today. He's been reporting on the trade dispute. Nathan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Nathan, the company announced this in a public filing. What did they say exactly?
Well, they announced that they feel like they have no option but to move some production out of the United States because the tariffs that the EU is applying to motorcycles are so significant that it'll cost them about $2,200 per bike. And they're saying that that is so cost prohibitive that they'll have to absorb that price in the interim. But in the meantime, they're going to have to locate production offshore because they just don't think that the customers will be willing to pay those extra costs.
Now, of course, this is an issue for Wisconsin. A lot of these bikes are produced here in the state. Did the company say anything about whether production would go down, jobs would be cut, or factories cut in the United States to make this happen in Europe?
I think that's what we expect to happen. What we don't know is where the cuts will occur. So we know recently, for example, they closed the plant in Kansas City, moved some of it to Pennsylvania. So that's already happening. Now, this would be in addition to that. And, whether Wisconsin factories are at risk, I certainly think that's possible. We're talking about 40,000 bicycle or motorcycles every year sold in Europe by Harley-Davidson. So 40,000 bicycles, I'm sorry, keep saying that, motorcycles, that's pretty significant volume. So I don't think that they can get away with a pretty small cut here. I think this will be significant. And, I think it's, it shows you that there are substantive, policy issue ramifications for the tariff spat that we're seeing between the EU and the U.S.
And Harley-Davidson is kind of getting it on both sides here because people, I think, including you, had already been writing about steel and aluminum tariffs. Well, if those costs get higher, that's going to affect a company in the United States like Harley that's making stuff with those raw materials. So they're facing higher costs on that end. And then with these retaliatory tariffs, they're facing a higher cost when they sell. This back and forth is having a lot of maybe unintended consequences.
Yeah, it is. It's ratcheting up. And you're right that this all started with the steel and aluminum tariffs that President Trump imposed on Europe. And citing this as a national security issue, which I think a lot of experts have already questioned whether it's legitimately a national security issue or not. But the bottom line is that for Harley-Davidson, that increased the cost of doing business. And this is really bad timing for them because they are already struggling. And, in the U.S., millennials have already, shown less interest than older consumers at buying Harley-Davidson motorcycles. And so, this is just another issue that they have to deal with.
U.S. Senator Ron Johnson from here in Wisconsin, he's a Republican. He released a statement earlier this afternoon saying this confirms his concerns and quoting here, it's a far too predictable outcome of policies that give companies like Harley-Davidson incentives to make their products elsewhere. So this is something that is getting backlash among Republicans, Nathan.
Yeah, and I think that, tariffs are very interesting because they scramble the traditional political boundaries. You see sometimes unions will support the tariffs and sometimes they won't. You see sometimes Republicans will be for them, sometimes against them. I think it depends on the specific issue. This is interesting, though, because the question all along was, will the tariffs actually increase prices or will they affect production? Here we see that Harley-Davidson is saying they cannot afford to raise prices on these motorcycles in the EU, but it will cause them to shift production. So, they're saying that the price won't necessarily go up, but the jobs could be cut here in the US. And so will that happen with other products? It's a little too early to tell, but you see how swiftly Harley-Davidson took action because these tariffs took effect on Friday. Here we are Monday, and they're announcing this news.
Nathan Bomey is with us, business reporter with USA Today, talking about Harley-Davidson's decision, their announcement earlier today that they're going to shift some production to their second biggest market, the European Union, in response to back-and-forth tariffs. Nathan, speculating here, President Trump is talking about higher tariffs on German cars now coming into this country. Could this balance out where the German car maker says, well, we can't afford to send our cars over there. We better shift some of our production to the United States.
I certainly think that's a possibility. And so that's an interesting situation as well, because we have seen for many years now, the automotive industry has moved a lot of production to the countries where they're selling the products. And so that has hurt the U.S. and benefited the U.S. at the same time, because if you look at the Japanese automakers, for example, Toyota and Honda and Nissan have all brought pretty significant plants to the United States. On the other hand, we see that, of course, all the automakers have expanded in foreign markets as well to serve those markets. And so with the German companies, BMW, Volkswagen, and Daimler, which makes Mercedes, those three in particular face a real significant problem here with these tariffs, because a high percentage of the vehicles they sell in the U.S. are made in Europe. And so if these tariffs that President Trump is threatening on European vehicles actually take effect, that could cause them some real problems in the dealership, because I don't think they can afford to raise prices. These vehicles are already expensive. They're in a pretty, tight competition with other brands that will not face these types of tariffs like Lexus and Cadillac. So there's competition there. So yeah, the German automakers are definitely trembling at that news.
It's cheese day here in Wisconsin, and people are talking about risks to Wisconsin cheese exports with retaliatory tariffs. Can you talk about the range, Nathan, of products you're seeing from the United States that are going to hit some kind of tariff bump, if not wall?
Yeah, there's a really strange mix of products that the EU is threatening here in response to the steel and aluminum tariffs. It ranges from everything from a deck of playing cards to pants to, various agricultural products. But one that I found pretty interesting was cranberries, for example, which obviously a Midwestern product. And cranberries, are not a product where you can necessarily shift to another plant or anything like that. But what we see is that with the EU threatening American cranberries with increased tariffs, there's a concern among the Cranberry Council that European countries could start buying cranberries from Canada instead, because Canada has a duty-free deal there with the EU on those products. So that's a legitimate concern as well. And again, sometimes a product may not be easily available, readily available in another market, but other times it is. And so I think the impact is fairly uneven and depends on the specific product.
So we're at a state right now where we tariff, they tariff, we tariff back. I mean, are we just going to keep seeing more shoes drop, or is there any kind of sign that we're going to calm things down?
Well, I do think that that's the concern, and that's why the markets are sort of, shaking in their boots right now, because the fear is of a much worse trade war being sparked. I don't think that the tariffs that have taken effect so far are extremely damaging to the economy, because although tens of billions sounds like a lot with an economy that's many, many trillions of dollars, not necessarily huge. But I think the concern is that this just escalates to a level that is where it gets to be very damaging. And so that's the fear, especially with China, because I do think that some of this is strategic when it comes to the U.S. and Europe. If you're willing to sort of do it to your allies, then China will say, well, surely we'll do it to us. And I think some of it's strategic maneuvering. Whether it's smart or not, I'm not sure. But it certainly could trigger something worse, and that's the fear.
Nathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Hey, thanks.
That's Nathan Bomey, business reporter with USA Today, with us to talk about Harley-Davidson's announcement that it'll be moving some operations to the European Union to avoid tariffs. First, the way we shop has come a long way in not much time. We no longer have to drive to the store to look at their product selection if we don't want to, but even the online shopping world is facing competition. Several Chinese-based manufacturers are selling their products directly to consumers straight from their factory online, mostly skipping the retailer middleman. Have you ever used a site like AliExpress, Wish.com, or bought a product at Amazon that was sent straight from a Chinese factory? Call 800-642-1234 to share your experience. That's 800-642-1234. How did it work out for you? Alana Semuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She wrote the piece, The Problem with Buying Cheap Stuff Online. Alana, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, people think online shopping, they probably think of Amazon or maybe, you know, a retailer they're familiar with. This is something a little different. Can you talk about how this works, getting stuff basically shipped right from that factory in China?
Sure. I mean, you often think about buying something from, you know, a Target, for example. And then, you know, once we didn't go to Targets as much anymore, we buy something from Target.com, where there are buyers who kind of selected stuff from, you know, a lot of it might have come from China. They imported it and then they were responsible for getting it to you. Now there's this whole field of people that are just sending it directly from China. So kind of skipping that retailer middleman. They've become really good at figuring out how to kind of game search terms and list their products and can sell them for pretty cheap because they're cutting out the middleman.
Yeah, the products look really cheap. They're not always matched up with what we might be comparing their price with, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, when you're going to save money online, you're probably not going to get a high quality product. But, you know, if you're just looking for a $2 blanket, you don't necessarily need a high quality blanket, you know, it can be a good option for saving money.
What I would think about is, okay, if you're putting something in a package in China, shipping it to me here in the United States, isn't that going to be a lot of shipping?
You would think it would be a lot of shipping costs, but the U.S. Postal Service has actually signed this treaty. You know, most countries' postal services are in this treaty, and it basically says if you're in this treaty, we'll deliver the goods for you. You know, the Chinese Postal Service will get it here, and then the U.S. Postal Service will pick it up and deliver it. And the rates are extremely, extremely low. So it can actually be less expensive for someone to sell something to New York from China than it would be for example, North Carolina.
Wow. So is anybody trying to, like, work that out to make it cheaper to ship within the United States? That seems like a weird phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen President Trump talk about this U.S. Postal Service Commission and looking into Postal Service rates. I mean, I think that's one of the things that this Postal Service Commission would look into. On the other hand, the more volume that goes through the U.S. Postal Service, the better for the Postal Service. So, you know, you don't necessarily want to discourage people from shipping from China because package delivery is an increasing part of the Postal Service's business. It's just about figuring out what the right rate is. And then, of course, as the U.S. Potentially ships more stuff to other countries, we wouldn't want to have to pay a much higher rate to ship to China, for example.
Want to bring on a caller who I think has tried this out. Michael is with us in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I buy many sports jerseys online from Chinese direct retailers, and I would say about 60% of the time I get a good product, and then the other 40%, it's something that I, you know, wouldn't want to wear. You know, it doesn't look like what a true trademark jersey would look like. But I still do it because that 60% of the time, the jerseys are so cheap that I can, you know, take the gamble and still come out ahead.
Thanks for that call, Michael. And yeah, that's a product line. I bet people do this a lot. Alana, as a parent of soccer fans, I know official jerseys are really expensive. It's pretty tempting if you're getting them for, what, 10% of the cost.
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of these companies have actually pretty decent return or refund policies. So, you know, Wish, which is one of the sites I wrote about, I talked to a woman who said, you know, she gets a lot of crap and then she kind of calls them and they say, oh, we'll just give you your money back. Don't worry about returning it. So, you know, it can work out well if you know how to game the customer service game. On the other hand, you know, I have heard of people that have said, this is not what I wanted. This is, you know, something's misspelled. This doesn't make any sense. And they never hear back. So it can be a gamble.
Yeah. Now, you took this for a spin yourself, Alana, trying to get this ridiculously cheap watch, fitness thingy, whatever. What did you end up with?
Yeah, so I really wanted a smartwatch. I have a lot of friends that have Apple Watches and thought they were looking pretty cool, but they're really expensive. So I got a smartwatch for $18 on Wish. It had supposedly been marked down from $900. I find that very hard to believe. And it strangely had 8,000 reviews in an average 4 out of 5 stars. But I got it, and, you know, I'd hoped that it would kind of track my steps, take pictures, I'd be able to get emails and texts. I couldn't find a SIM card that fit in it, and I actually went to Chinatown in San Francisco to try to find one, and a few people helped me and just kind of said, you know, this is defective. And then I tried to use a pedometer function. That didn't work. The camera, you had to hold it at a really weird angle to take a picture. So I basically just use it as an alarm now, and I'm a little worried just doing that because you don't want to, you know, have to use it to wake up for an important call and then the alarm doesn't go off. So for $18, I did not get a really great product.
Talking to Alana Semuels from The Atlantic, her piece, The Problem with Buying Cheap Stuff Online, talking about buying stuff kind of at our own risk, direct from Chinese factories. Back to your calls. Angie is with us in central Wisconsin. Angie, hi.
Hi, I buy a lot of things to make jewelry with, and I have a small business I sell on Etsy and craft fairs and things, and although I wouldn't buy precious stones or anything, but the basic little parts that you need, and the reason I started buying from places like D.H. Gates and AliExpress is because Google is overcome with their advertisements. I would do a search for a product I wanted, and I might find 20 results from Chinese companies and one or two from American companies. And I pay like $2 shipping. I have to plan ahead because it takes a while to get the things, but you just can't beat the price.
Angie, thanks for that call. You mentioned, Alana, they're really gaming the advertising system online.
Yeah, you see Wish, especially in a lot of really interesting places. For example, they just bought ads on the LA Lakers jerseys. So, you know, you wouldn't think that's necessarily a place for a direct from China company to advertise. But if you watch Lakers games, you see that. And then, you know, Wish is really, a lot of these companies are very aggressive on Facebook. So there is actually a pretty funny blog article about all the weird Facebook ads that people were getting. I think they were kind of working with their system and people were just getting these weird ads for like, one of them was a plastic thing that basically helps you hold your sunflower seeds as you're shelling them. Another one was a bizarre face mask. There's one that is just a fake tongue that just looks like a very realistic tongue, but it's just a tongue.
Somebody needs it.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, even if you just go on some of these sites and start browsing around, you can kind of imagine this scene of these manufacturers in China trying to figure out what do Americans want and how do we sell it to them and what are the keywords they're clicking on. And you know, it must be a really interesting scene over there.
Angie, thanks for that call. Go next to Darren in Eau Claire. Darren, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I've been using Wish a lot. Just use it actually to purchase a raft for the French Town annual tube float here in Chippewa. And it came. It was in great shape. It was, I found a similar model on Amazon for $280, and it cost me $80 with shipping. So I was very happy with it, and I didn't sink. So, but on the other hand, I've had bad experiences. So like previous callers, you really do take that gamble, because I did have a cooler float that didn't show. But like you say, if you just click on that, at least for Wish app, if you just click on that customer support, they'll give you your money back, and it's hard to beat it.
Darren, thanks for that call. One concern we haven't gotten into too much, Alana, though it came up a bit with the sports jerseys, is are we buying illegally counterfeited products when we do this?
Yeah, in a lot of cases you are, and that can even be on sites like Amazon or some of the sites that you think of as more kind of reputable. And it's just because the internet is really, in a lot of ways, just kind of the wild, wild west, and sellers can post things. And, you know, it can be really hard to know if the sellers are legitimate, if the sellers are knocking things off. I actually had another experience where I bought these Apple earpods, or AirPods they're called, on Amazon. And, you know, they were, I knew they probably weren't legitimate because they were pretty cheap. but they came and they didn't really work. And, you know, I contacted Apple and they didn't, you know, want to say anything about Amazon in particular, but a lot of these big tech companies are increasingly having trouble preventing these counterfeits from being sold because it's so easy through the internet for counterfeiters to sell them. And, you know, there's some examples of hoverboards, for instance, where people bought hoverboards online that were counterfeit and they ended up catching on fire and burning down houses. So you definitely have to be careful with what you're buying.
And briefly, Alana, some of our listeners on Facebook have raised the concerns about the impact on retailers here in the United States. Can you just touch on that in a few moments?
Yeah, I think, you know, online shopping is hurting retailers already, but these goods from China are so much cheaper than the goods, you know, you can buy in a store just because there are fewer labor protections and, you know, labor is really cheap in China. So I think if this keeps growing, it could be even more of a threat to retail than sites like Amazon are.
We'll leave it there. Alana, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Alana Semuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She joined us to talk about her piece, The Problem with Buying Cheap Stuff Online. Now, the U.S. Senate passed its version of the National Defense Authorization Act last week with $716 billion in defense spending for 2019. The bill now has to be reconciled with a version passed by the House in May. Both bills passed with broad bipartisan support and represent a buildup in funding from previous budgets. Money in both is slated for new fighter jets, ships, a military pay raise, and some nuclear weapons. Connor O'Brien is a senior defense reporter for Politico. He's here to help us break down those bills. Connor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we dig into the specifics, broad strokes, how big an increase would this defense and military budget be compared to the last couple of budgets?
Sure. Well, to give you a sense, this is what we call a policy or an authorization bill. It doesn't actually provide the funding for the Pentagon, but it does lay out kind of in broad terms what the budget is going to be and what we are going to spend, how much we're going to spend on certain weapons programs and things like that. It would be overall $716 billion in the low 600s for the Pentagon, plus an extra nearly $70 billion for U.S. war efforts abroad in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, and then the rest of that going towards nuclear weapons programs in the Energy Department. How does that stack up to previous years? Well, it's a very big buildup, considering the last budget that during the Obama administration, it was about, this would be about $80 billion over that. So it's a very big buildup in just a couple of years. Lawmakers struck a budget deal a few months ago that very much, that drastically increases both spending on the defense side of the ledger, but also on those domestic programs, too. So there have been comparisons to other periods, and in the last about four decades, this would essentially be a peak for defense spending outside of the height of the Iraq War when you adjust for inflation.
Republican Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma managed the bill on the Senate side. Here's a listen to what he had to say about the increase in spending.
We are not ahead. Most of us like to go out back home where the real people are and talk about what is that we have the very best of everything in our military. Well, we've been able to say that until fairly recently. We don't anymore.
Is there a case to be made? He went on to make the case that Russia and China have technological advantages over the U.S. military. Is the U.S. Military hollowed out or falling behind in some sense?
Well, so that's the contention that you hear from folks like Senator Inhofe, who's a senior member of the Armed Services Committee, and also from senior Pentagon officials, that while the U.S. might still be ahead, it's losing its edge to Russia and China that have been, that have been investing very heavily in R&D and in their militaries, while the United States has maybe not done so much. There are a few things here. So in 2013, there were a series of budget cuts to both the Pentagon and to all these other federal agencies. It's known commonly as sequestration. And, pro-defense lawmakers, you call them defense hawks, oftentimes, have pointed to that as basically really kind of arresting a lot of progress that the military has made, decaying the readiness, basically the how ready our troops are to go into fight and, maintenance, suffering, and things like that. So essentially the claim that these defense hawks have made, the mostly Republicans, is that the military is not in the kind of shape it was even a few years ago, that there need to be very large investments to kind of to get our fighting force back in shape to kind of to meet the challenges of what we call great powers, so Russia, China, and also the current fights that the United States is in. They're claiming that this very large increase in funding is needed for that, and also to prep the United States military for the future.
It seems like the defense hawks made their case in Congress anyway. These passed with pretty broad bipartisan support, right?
Yes. Well, this is a bill that's has passed for nearly 60 straight years. I think it's 57 straight years now that it's been enacted into law. There have been some bumps along the way, but this is usually legislation that passes with healthy bipartisan support. Most members of Congress of both parties agree that national security is a priority, should be funded, regularly and with stable funding. There are issues within the bill, however, that do kind of sometimes fall to some partisan infighting. But by and large, there are many members of Congress with, a base back home in their state or their district or a key Pentagon contractor back home. And there are many members. It's easier to find the members of Congress that don't benefit from passing this bill than the ones whose districts and states do benefit.
Talking to Connor O'Brien, senior defense reporter for Politico, about this appropriations budget for defense spending. One version passed the House, another one just passed the Senate last week. Now they got to wrinkle out the details there. Speaking of topics of interest to specific areas, here in Wisconsin, we have these littoral combat vessels for closer to coastal naval combat, I believe. How's that playing out in these budgets?
Well, that's probably as far as naval issues and the shipbuilding budget. That's actually one of the more contentious issues that lawmakers are going to have to hammer out in this process. So you have basically four areas that need to kind of come to an agreement on how many of these ships to fund. The House and the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House and the Senate Appropriations Committee, which actually provide the funding. So this Senate bill that passed last week funded only one littoral combat ship, which is what the Navy requested. The Navy wants to wind down that program while it ramps up a new ship called what they're calling the Frigate right now. And the House version of the defense bill that passed last month would fund three of those. So that'll be a major issue of contention. There are influential members from both Wisconsin, where one version is built, and Alabama, where the other version of the littoral combat ship is built. Folks like including Mike Gallagher, who represents, I believe, the Marinette shipyard. Mm-hmm. So these folks will be fighting for that interest and try to get the higher number. It's unclear. They're going to have to find, obviously, the money for that. But that'll be as far as the issue. How big of a Navy do they want to build, and how many ships do they want to buy for the Navy this year? Littoral combat ship will be on the front line of that.
Another issue that seemed to get some controversy was a tactical nuclear launch vehicle, a submarine, a short-range, low-yield tactical nuclear weapon. What's going on there?
Well, that came from a nuclear blueprint called the Nuclear Posture Review that the Trump administration laid out a few months ago. And in addition to kind of modernizing what we call the triad, which is the land, air, and sea-based legs of our nuclear arsenal. It calls for expanding the arsenal to these so-called low-yield weapons, you know, kind of a lower blast that can be launched from a submarine. And there, the administration requested $65 million to start developing these weapons, which, as far as Pentagon weapons go, is kind of a drop in the bucket. But obviously, it's encountered some opposition from Democrats primarily, who believe that this weapon is destabilizing, that that essentially a nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon. And that if you, their argument is that if you believe that that a tactical nuclear weapon is can be used in a more efficient manner than a larger nuclear weapon, that is going to increase the likelihood of nuclear war. Now, Democrats in the House and the Senate have tried to rip this funding out of the bill and have been unsuccessful. So both versions of the House and the Senate defense bill right now have this language authorizing these new weapons. So we're going to have to see what they come out with, but it's increasingly likely that these are going to be authorized, at least initially. The funding obviously has to come through too, but it's advocates of these new weapons, you know, who say that Russia already has it, that this is us just keeping pace with them, you know, they appear to kind of have won this round.
We're talking to Connor O'Brien, senior defense reporter at Politico, looking at the National Defense Authorization Act making its way through Congress. A version of that has passed the House and now the Senate. Now they have to work out the details. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. As our guest says, this is a substantial increase in defense spending as compared to the last few budgets. Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think the U.S. military needs this increased funding or not? What aspects of the military do you think should be a priority in this bill? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Connor O'Brien, senior defense reporter for Politico, looking at the National Defense Authorization Act. A version has passed the House and the Senate, working out the details now. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. These include an increase, a substantial one, in defense spending. Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think it's important to keep the military up to date? Do you have concerns about funding over the last few years under the era of sequestration? And do you have questions for our guest about how this is all working out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Connor, this also includes a pay raise for troops. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. It greenlights a 2.6% pay raise, and that's something that the administration and that lawmakers have kind of been touting as in the size of it. It's the largest in almost a decade.
I want to go to a caller now. We have Bob on the line in Jacksonport. Bob, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to know if your guest is aware of a report that was just sent to Congress, and I'm sorry, I don't have that information in front of me. But it essentially states that the supply chain for conventional bombs is in jeopardy for a number of reasons. Number one, we're dropping about a bomb every 12 minutes that we don't even much hear about. And secondly, that along the supply chain, there's pinch points, single source, Chinese suppliers. So I'm just wondering if you're aware of that and where that's going. And secondly, how many trillions are we unable to account for that the Pentagon has spent?
Bob, thanks for the call. A couple of big issues. Let's start with that last one first. There have been questions about audits of the military, how well we're keeping track of military appropriations. Is that something you're tracking, Connor?
Yes. Well, so the Pentagon is actually undergoing its first ever audit this year under Secretary Mattis, and that's kind of been made one of the top priorities of his time as secretary. You know, it is tough. The Pentagon is the only major department that hasn't undergone a full audit, and so this should be, the expectation is that this should be, this first audit should be wrapped up in the fall, and it will have a, it should give people a better idea of where they can and can't track the money. And it is, and it is a source of frustration on Capitol Hill in both parties. That is a, that is, that's been a complaint from, you know, people of every political stripe, from John McCain, perhaps the biggest defense hawk on Capitol Hill, to Bernie Sanders, perhaps the most progressive member of the Senate, you know, complaining that, you know, how can they ensure that every single dollar is well spent? And it's been, that's been a reason, that was a reason that some senators opposed this bill, was because of the inability to track that money and when it could go elsewhere where there are domestic priorities.
Bob also mentioned issues of supply chain for various military supplies, especially in this era of tariff wars. Is that something that comes up in a debate over an appropriations bill?
Well, yes. There have obviously been concerns about the supply chain. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the report that he referenced. But when he's talking about bombs that we've dropped, you know, that has been a concern actually from the Pentagon, where there have been, they've stepped up military operations in the Middle East and Afghanistan to such an extent that they're in many cases running short on munitions, or other regions are donating their munitions and they're running short because the current fights that we're in are taking precedent. On the supply chain, there have been a number of concerns about the defense supply chain. The Pentagon is supposed to come out at some point with its assessment of the supply chain and the defense industrial base in the coming weeks and months. Another thing worth noting here, I think, is that the Senate defense authorization bill includes an overhaul of what's called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And that is the oversight board that basically approves foreign takeovers of foreign investment in the United States, foreign companies coming in and investing in U.S. companies. And the concern there is that that is leading to countries, specifically China, from accessing U.S. technology that... sensitive U.S. technology because of a lack of oversight. So they want to firm that up. That is in the Senate bill. There is no real version of it in the House bill, so that's going to have to be something that they're going to really work hard to refine as they go into their negotiations in the coming weeks.
Talking to Connor O'Brien, senior defense reporter for Politico, about the defense appropriation bills in the Senate and the House. I want to give a listen. You'd mentioned Senator Bernie Sanders. He was one of, I believe, 10 senators to vote against the bill. Here's a little of what he had to say on the Senate floor.
What this debate should be about, and unfortunately it will not be about, is our national priorities. Do we have to spend more money on defense than the next 10 countries combined when children in America go hungry, when veterans sleep out on the street, when we are the only major country that does not guarantee health care to all people? I say no.
Was there a lot of that kind of butter versus guns debate, or was it just Senator Sanders bringing that up?
It was mostly Senator Sanders. However, that is a that is a common concern among progressives that essentially this amount of money, $716 billion, is a lot of money to spend on any federal program, much less one single department like the military. Now, advocates say this is what we need because we've neglected our military and we need to properly fund it. But, you know, Democrats have pointed to the fact that under President Trump and under Republican leadership, taxes have been cut. That adds $1.5 trillion to the debt over the next 10 years, perhaps more, some estimates say, and that there are other pressing needs on what we call the domestic side of the ledger, things like health care, education, transportation, and that those are getting short shrift. So there is a lot of that criticism, and frankly, there will be, because the deficit was projected to grow even before taxes were cut, there will have to be kind of some assessment in the next few years about how much gets spent on the military in relation to everything else, as there was, like I said, in 2013 when sequestration happened, because the deficit was at very high levels and this was the easiest thing to cut, and rather than mandatory programs or raising taxes.
Let's bring on one more caller, Andy in Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just had I had a question for your speaker there. It seems like, I want to say it was like a year or two ago that I heard all over the news about various members of the military agreeing with the more liberal side that military spending does need to be cut. And I'm just trying to find out what within the administration on, you know, that line of thinking.
Andy, thanks. Had we heard any calls from within the military for spending cuts on the military, Connor?
Well, it's interesting because in the early part of the Trump administration, the administration actually proposed a budget that was lower than what many Republicans wanted. There were, back when, obviously, Robert Gates was secretary during the first Obama term, there was kind of this move towards a lower defense budget as we pulled out of Iraq, as you know, as the force got smaller, and in the end of the Obama administration, actually the defense secretary and many senior defense officials were defending a lower or a very different budget proposal than what Republicans in Congress were advocating for, and you know, to line up with the administration's plans for federal spending. Now, there have been some differences in the beginning of the Trump administration. The Pentagon's budget was considerably lower than what leaders of the House and Senate Armed Services Committee wanted, and those folks, led by Senator McCain, came out early and often and said that they needed a particular level of spending in this case.
And we have to jump in. Connor O'Brien, thanks for joining us, defense reporter for Politico.